Like the Buddha, now we can say, if it's possible for me, it's possible for everybody. I can go help bring those people up. This is the aspiration of the warrior bodhisattva and the basis of enlightened society. 21. Warrior in the world. When we talk about enlightened society, we aren't talking about some utopia where everyone's enlightened. We're talking about a culture of human beings who know the awakened nature of basic goodness and invoke its energy in order to courageously extend themselves to others. Their motivation is allied with compassion, love, and wisdom. This enlightened attitude is not inhibited. It accommodates and incorporates the vicissitudes of life. To meet our basic goodness, we meditate. Through peaceful abiding, we learn to rest fearlessly in our natural state. We see what an enlightened being sees. Basic goodness is the ground of being, the nature of everything. It's an indestructible continuum, a diamond hologram with infinite facets. Through contemplation, we discover that, like the reflection of a jewel in the sunlight, it is empty. In continuing to contemplate, we see that this emptiness is vibrant and dynamic, a playful display of thoughts, emotions, and perceptions. This is luminosity. We experience basic goodness when we relax deeply into how things are, without wanting to change them. From that supple state, bodhicitta naturally flows. This is the mind of enlightenment. By using meditation to dissolve the illusion of me, we ally ourselves with it. Now we can rely on its energy, just as we can rely on the energy of a horse. The majestic spirit of our wild horse mind has been tamed and gathered into wind horse, the primordial energy of basic goodness. Our practice now lies in riding it. We call it wind horse because its nature is uplifted, strong, exuberant, and brilliant. It's running and the mane is flying. When I was in Tibet, I saw wind horse in the bearing of warriors on horseback who were dressed as King Gezer, Tibet's epic hero. Making the mind an ally gives us the power to ride the radiant wind horse in any situation. Riding the energy of basic goodness is like riding the rays of a sun that is always rising. In the Shambhala Buddhist tradition, we call it the Great Eastern Sun. Everything we encounter shines with the dignity and splendor of basic goodness, and we see a sacred world. With this view, we are beginning to lay the foundation of an enlightened society. How do we live from the stainless, pure ground of basic goodness? How do we generate a compassionate heart in every encounter? How do we plant the flower of bodhicitta on the rock of a dark age? The quickest, most practical way to do this is to keep loosening our grip on ourselves. This is when wind horse is most accessible. It all comes back to one of my favorite sayings. If you want to be miserable, think about yourself. If you want to be happy, think of others. This is how we bring enlightened mind down to earth. When he achieved enlightenment, the Buddha used earth as his witness. He later taught 6 paramitas, courageous ways to live on earth. The word denotes a process. Arriving at the other side. We ground our behavior in these actions, which will keep us moving beyond small motivation into the sacred outlook of the Great Eastern Sun. Generosity, patience, exertion, discipline, meditation, and prajna are the enlightened activities of the warrior bodhisattva. It's the wisdom of prajna that makes them enlightened, transforming them from conventional virtues into ways to go beyond the darkness of samsara. Prajna uses the other paramitas to put bodhicitta into action. The power of these activities is that they help us become comfortable with basic goodness. They support us in relaxing into the ground of our authentic being. They also support each other. Continuously offering in the spirit of generosity enriches the discipline of non-attachment. Discipline in keeping our heart and mind open increases patience. Having patience gives staying power to exertion. Acting with joyful exertion for the benefit of others strengthens meditation. The mind of meditation sharpens prajna, which sees things as they are. Prajna uses the other activities to keep activating bodhicitta, our lightest mind. It's light because it lacks the reference point of a self. This also gives us a sense of humor. Generosity, jinpa, is the first paramita. It's the treasure of the warrior bodhisattva because it keeps us from holding on to ourselves. Because we have a pliable mind, we can let go. Generosity dispels self-centeredness and the desire to consume, which obscure basic goodness and dampen our ability to love. Sometimes it's hard to be generous in our practice. Often when we try to generate love and compassion, we find that we can't extend our heart to those beyond our immediate circle. Even at the level of aspiration, we're stingy. We think, why would I care about those neutral people? What have they done for me? We want so much for ourselves that we can't even offer the wish for others to be happy. We don't want to give, not even our thoughts and intentions. We wonder, how can simply thinking help others? But when we hear that someone's thinking about us, all of a sudden the tables turned and thoughts have great power. In reality, what have we done for anybody? We keep taking and consuming, both psychologically and materially, and then we expect more. The beauty of rousing love and compassion is that it forces us beyond this small view. Visualizing someone else experiencing happiness in the face of our attachment strengthens our ability to let go. Our mind becomes lighter. It becomes very clear that our grudges and desires are habitual ways of holding on to ourselves. Rousing bodhicitta is a way to turn our attitude toward generosity. It propels us to start giving rather than taking. Physical giving is a simple way to activate generosity. Giving clothing, gifts, money, time, or food liberates attachment and creates a conduit for love and compassion. At the moment we give, we are quite selfless. We can also offer words, giving condolences, comfort, confidence, courage, and strength. By generating an even larger intention as we're doing it, may all beings benefit, may I feed the whole world, we're expanding our treasure. I was amazed by the generosity of villagers in Tibet when I visited them in their very humble homes. They would offer me literally everything they had. Pictures, rugs, pots, pans, yaks, sheep. Their uninhibited generosity was genuine. It wasn't as if they were hoping that I wouldn't take their offerings. If I accepted, they were incredibly happy. Yet, sometimes in this world of plenty, we hide our box of chocolates when our friends come over. We're at the market looking at a beautiful display of fruit, and we want the person in front of us to get out of the way so we can have first pick. Sometimes we're even stingy with ourselves. We buy an article of clothing and we can't let ourselves enjoy wearing it. We keep saving it for a special occasion. This level of greed only causes pain. Holding on to anything is a way of holding on to ourselves. The way to get to the other side is to give without hesitation. If we're simply too stingy to offer to others, we can start by giving something from our left hand to our right hand. Once when I was with His Holiness Khyentse Rinpoche, a sick man came into the room, wanting a blessing to make him well. Rinpoche held him just like a father would. He didn't do anything special. He just let that person know he was okay. The most profound generosity we can offer is this kind of love and compassion. It doesn't matter whether somebody did something for us or not. We can offer our love and compassion. We can do it at any time, anywhere. Even by meeting someone else's eyes, we let go of where we're holding back. The ultimate generosity takes place at the level of wisdom, knowing the giver, the recipient, and the gift to be pure and empty. This is the most profound generosity because there is no attachment. The next transcendental activity is discipline, known as sultrim. Discipline is the eyes of the warrior. It is closely allied with awareness. With discipline, we hold our mind to the view of basic goodness, the stainless ground of being. We speak and act from bodhicitta, the genuine heart of tenderness that knows the richness and delight, the impermanence and suffering that dance upon that ground. Discipline is long-term, wide-angle perspective that gives us the wisdom to live beyond deception and discursiveness. Discipline sees the relationship between virtuous and non-virtuous activities. In meditation, we see that returning our mind to the breath or resting in the meaning of the words strengthens the mind of enlightenment. When we dwell in mental chatter, we become fearful and distracted. When we lose sight of love and compassion, we become stingy and angry. Discipline moves us beyond the ignorance of thinking we can do more or less what we want. When we have the discipline to practice meditation consistently, our mind grows stronger. Within the container of discipline, we can relax. For example, one day my friend Jeff and I were golfing. He's a decent player, but on this particular day, he'd somehow become very concerned about how far he could hit the ball. The more he tried to hit the ball, the worse his swing got. He was really playing very badly. I tried to talk to him about his swing, emphasizing that golf is about form, about elegance, as well as about how far the ball will go. By the time we got to the 13th hole, I said, "Your swing is so bad, for both our sakes, I'm going to try to help you. If you'll let me, I'll give you a free ball." I worked with his stance, with his hands, with his posture. He said it felt strange. I told him to step up to the ball and do exactly what I said. He stepped up, took the swing, hit the ball, and said, "That felt really good." It was a beautiful shot. The ball flew about 175 yards, came back on the green, and went into the hole. Jeff said, "It works. It really works." That's the power of discipline. We use discipline to clear the road for the future by deciding what to do and not to do now. It's learning what to accept and what to reject. We're able to see more and more clearly the difference between virtue and non-virtue, gewa and migewa. We see the nature of samsara and its pitfalls. Our minds are strong through practice, so we're not seduced into acting on negative emotions, even in our mind. We know such actions will create more pain for us. We turn our mind toward bodhicitta and wisdom instead. Through discipline, we begin to understand how to maneuver in the realm of karma. Discipline looks at any situation and asks, "What is the action? What is the result?" With discipline, we gather virtuous qualities. Peacefully abiding is virtuous. Radiating love and compassion is virtuous. Understanding impermanence, emptiness, karma, and samsara is virtuous. Abiding by the six paramitas is virtuous. By living our life this way, we begin to see that harmonizing our view with our actions is how we continue to wake up. So we abandon what is negative and gather what is positive. Discipline makes a container for enlightened activity. It sees when we're acting selfishly and when we're acting selflessly. It sees obstacles to our activity and applies the proper antidotes. For the warrior in the world, the most basic antidote to negativity is to radiate love and compassion. Patience, sopa, is built on discipline. Patience is our saddle. Staying in the saddle doesn't necessarily mean waiting patiently for the doctor, the bus, or the airplane. For the Bodhisattva warrior, patience is about overcoming anger and aggression. Aggression and anger are dangerous to the mind of enlightenment. In anger, we become totally absorbed, enslaved, and trapped. Anger often leads to action. It gives us the urge to kill others, which denies them the opportunity to discover their enlightened minds. Even if we refrain from acting on it, anger has the power to annihilate our wind horse and destroy our love, compassion, wisdom, generosity, discipline, exertion, meditation, and prajna as well. So we stay in the saddle of patience to counter that aggression. By learning to hold our mind to an object in meditation, we train in patience. Then when a moment of anger arises in our everyday life, we might be able to hold our speech, hold our action. We don't jump out, lash out, or act out. If we're really dedicated to practicing patience, we even learn to generate love and compassion on the spot when anger arises. It's possible. In that moment we're about to become angry, with discipline we can see what's happening and turn our mind to enlightenment instead. Even if we do this only briefly, it strengthens our practice tremendously. Patience means not resisting the nature of reality. We have the fortitude to stay in the saddle of big view and motivation. We don't mind wading through the river of impermanence. We enjoy riding across the plains of emptiness. We are happy even in difficult situations. We want to work for the welfare of others as long as it takes for everyone to realize the mind of enlightenment. From patience comes exertion, sondru. Exertion is our indestructible armor. It gleams with joy. With exertion, we celebrate basic goodness by extending our wind horse to others. We can do this because we've overcome laziness. We no longer dread practicing bodhicitta because we know it's who we are. We practice exertion with the carefree delight of a dusty elephant who jumps into a pool of water on a hot day. There is no way that elephant won't jump into that pool. This is how enthusiastic we feel in exerting ourselves for the benefit of others. Rousing bodhicitta is an occasion for continual delight. We can hardly wait to raise it again. If we were the only person in the whole world to be generating love and compassion, we would generate it with fearless joy and delight until the day we die. Our aspiration to help others is so great that we would gladly spend an eternity in hell even to help a child be less afraid to speak in class. Why are we so happy? Because we're free of me. Working to make me happy only causes pain. Working for the happiness of others brings joy. We're not practicing bodhicitta because it's good for us. We're practicing it because we know the living, empty, brilliant truth of basic goodness. When we know this truth, extending love and compassion is all there is to do. We no longer swim against the current of reality. This is the basis of our conduct as warrior bodhisattvas. Radiating the warmth of love is pure simplicity. Generating the cool rays of compassion is a relief. Maintaining the illusion of a solid separate self is drudgery. Hard labor with no sense of satisfaction. We no longer look for loopholes for how we can get out of practicing bodhicitta. We must use common sense, however. It's important to attend to ourselves first. It's like putting on our own oxygen mask once the airplane loses altitude. Then we can help others put on theirs. Also, we shouldn't take on projects that are too big, that we're unable to finish. For example, the people who travel with me when I go to India each year to study are often overwhelmed by the poverty and suffering they see. It makes them feel frantic. How will we help all these people? Too big an approach will only dishearten us. Undermine our activity. Perhaps we start with just one person, one family. It's important to pick acts of compassion or kindness that we can complete. then we can make the next one slightly bigger. It may not always be a smooth ride, but we never give up. We now see clearly that every action is an opportunity to ripen the mind of enlightenment, and we really want to go forward. The armor of exertion is also the armor of joy. The next paramita is meditation, samadhi, which means fully absorbed. By riding this horse, we continue to let go of ourselves and renounce the path of selfishness. We are totally stable in our renunciation and continual abandonment of samsara. We are intimately familiar with the endless cycle of suffering that comes through thinking that the self is real and trying to gratify it. We're committed to looking at the many ways samsara aims to trap us. We never let ourselves forget that in samsara lies no happiness. We are completely committed to letting go of the view of me. If we fall off the horse by acting selfishly, the paramita of meditation helps us regain our balance almost instantly. We're such experienced riders that we float with the horse's movement. We are completely one-pointed in our allegiance to the path of the warrior. The mind of basic goodness is our ally. We use its strength and clarity to move out of the darkness of bewilderment and suffering with the open heart of bodhicitta. Bodhicitta envelops us like sunlight on a mountain. Generating love and compassion is our natural response to any situation. We know that moving forward in the wisdom of the great Eastern Sun is the best way to renounce samsara. This ability to renounce samsara leads to the next paramita, prajna, the highest form of knowing. Prajna is a double-edged sword that arises from our meditative experience. It gleams silver in the sun of basic goodness, mirroring the stainless purity of everything just as it is. The mind that knows the truth of reality is potent and powerful, like a laser beam. It alone can free us from the delusion that we exist. It cuts through the walls of bewilderment and ignorance and makes them obsolete. It burns through confusion, jealousy, anger, self-deception, hesitation, and doubt. Any habitual pattern that wants to solidify our view, our meditation, or our activity. It sees what is, and lights the way to liberate others from the bewilderment that keeps them trapped in the darkness of suffering. This sword is the ultimate weapon of the bodhisattva warrior. Generosity, discipline, patience, exertion, meditation, and wisdom keep turning our mind to enlightenment like a flower seeking sunlight. This brings genuine delight. The more awake we are, the more connected we feel with other sentient beings. The more awake we are, the more we want to help others achieve the same freedom. How do we help? How do we help others see their basic goodness, learn to touch their broken open hearts? How do we lead others to the mind of enlightenment? In describing the motivation of bodhicitta, the Buddha used the image of a shepherd herding his sheep in front of him. This may not be very practical. How could we encourage others into full enlightenment before we have gotten there ourselves? It might be more realistic to see ourselves as warrior kings and queens, riding our wind horse with majesty, elegance, and richness. We can take the paramitas as a code of enlightened behavior. We can use these qualities as currency in our transactions with others. This is how we can inspire others to discover their own basic goodness. This is how we can encourage them to follow the path of warriorhood. This is how we can help. Our intention is that of a shepherd, but our actions are those of a loving, wise, compassionate leader. If we all act according to this code, we will create an enlightened society. We can take this image to heart in going about our daily activity. If we're driving on the freeway, if we're working in an office, if we're having dinner with our friends, if we're changing diapers, if we're at the movies, we can visualize ourselves sitting tall in the saddle of patience astride the horse of meditation. Our eyes are the eyes of discipline. Close to our heart rests the treasure of generosity. We are protected by the armor of exertion, and in our right hand we hold the gleaming sword of Prajna. We are riding on the rays of the great eastern sun, endlessly and courageously for the benefit of all. With the mind as our ally, and this code of enlightened behavior, it is our duty and joy to serve others. This doesn't mean becoming a doormat. It means seeing clearly what the skillful action is in every situation. That is living from the mind of enlightenment. Generating love and compassion is how we live our lives in full bloom. If we don't make progress in this way, we are strengthening the circle of suffering instead. Doing the same self-serving things year after year, getting closer and closer to death. That's a waste of time, a waste of wind horse. When we live life in service to ourselves, our life force naturally diminishes. How do we avoid wasting ourselves? By including meditation in our daily life, and by rousing our enlightened qualities whenever we can. If we feel disheartened or depressed, visualizing a horse running through a beautiful meadow will stimulate a sense of empowerment. It gives us lightness and levity, as though anything is possible. This incredibly potent life force is wind horse. We always have the opportunity to raise it here and now. Saddling up and riding it is how we become the kings and queens of our own lives. The journey of the Bodhisattva warrior starts with the basic attitude of enlarging our motivation to include the welfare of others. This is a simple response to this dark age. Let's begin right now by engaging love and compassion however we can, not tomorrow, but today. By cultivating courage and confidence in ourselves and maintaining our seat, we can enjoy creating a sane environment. We can enjoy creating an enlightened society. This doesn't have to be overwhelming. Start by looking at your own life and see what you can do, one step at a time. Love is the saving grace. It's the Buddha in you standing up and saying, "Even though it's dark, I have this jewel." By this merit, may all obtain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy, wrongdoing from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death. From the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings. By the confidence of the golden sun of the great east, may the lotus garden of the Rigdon's wisdom bloom. May the dark ignorance of sentient beings be dispelled. May all beings enjoy profound, brilliant glory. Appendix A. Preparing to practice. The best support for regular and consistent meditation practice is that we enjoy doing it. If we prepare for it properly and make it a regular part of our life, it becomes like drinking water. So, before we get to the cushion, we need to look at our lifestyle and prepare for practice properly. The basic premise of meditation is not too tight, not too loose. We can apply the principles of gentleness and precision in every aspect of the practice. Without precision, we'll be unable to establish a strong container in which our practice can thrive. So we establish a routine, follow it with discipline, and stick to the instructions. Without gentleness, meditation will become just another way in which we're trying to measure up against a hopeless ideal. So we provide ourselves with the time and space to meditate, respect our limits, and soften up our minds and bodies properly. It's important not to expect perfection or get hooked on the finer points of the instruction. With gentleness and precision, meditation practice will bring us joy. Beginning meditation practice is an excellent opportunity to contemplate how we spend our time. How much of what we do is important and truly necessary? One of the obstacles to meditation is being pulled in too many directions. What drains us? What nourishes us? Are there activities we can postpone or eliminate? it will be helpful to ask questions like these at the outset. Awareness lays the ground for a strong commitment to practice. Taming our mind isn't a hobby or an extracurricular activity. It's the most important thing we could be doing. It can even help streamline a pressured situation because it gives us clarity, peace, and fortitude. So while we may need to simplify our life in order to meditate, a benefit of meditation is that it will make our life simpler. The next step is to establish a basic routine for meditation. When will you practice, and where? For many people, meditation works well in the morning. For others, evening is better. Some will find it effective to sandwich their day between two short sessions. Experiment with different times until you discover what's best. Once you settle on a regular time, stick to it. This is how to develop a daily rhythm of meditation. Establishing a definite practice time frees you of having to plan from day to day. You can also free yourself from worrying about how long you will practice. If you decide to meditate for 20 minutes, stay in your seat for that period of time, unless the house is on fire. Use a timer so that you can just relax into the practice without thinking about the minutes passing. A successful meditation practice is a consistent practice. The best way to do shamatha or contemplation is in short sessions consistently for a very long time. 10 to 20 minutes of sitting practice a couple of times daily over a lifetime is good. Of course, we can do longer sessions whenever we want. It's better to do consistent shorter sessions over a long period of time, however, than to do longer sessions sporadically or not at all. The recipe that works for most people is short sessions every day. Doing short sessions at the beginning and end of the day is very good for stabilizing the mind. If you're not able to meditate every day and you decide to do it twice or three times a week, the important thing is just to stay with it. Adapt your practice to your schedule. When you have less time, do shorter sessions. If we meditate haphazardly, doing a big session of practice one day and not returning to the cushion for a month, we won't enjoy meditation. That approach is frenzied and stressful, like digging a big hole in the garden and then forgetting about it. When we return, we have to start from scratch. Meditation in spurts is uncomfortable and painful because it can't ride on the cumulative effect of regular practice. We have to keep starting over. We need to apply ourselves consistently. Sitting for short sessions on a regular basis is a more gentle approach. One of the most common reasons that people stop meditating is that they mismanage their time. Being ambitious about having the perfect situation for practice can also work against us. I have a student who began with meditation practice in his 20s and was quite disciplined with a regular practice of an hour a day. Then, as he became busy with his career, he couldn't keep the schedule going, and his practice dropped away. He told himself that once he got more stability in his life, he would begin to sit again. But then he got married and had a family. Having a regular hour-long practice became an even more remote possibility. Instead of simply shortening his sessions and letting his life fall into place around practice, he got caught thinking that he could create a perfect lifestyle to accommodate his longer sessions. As a result, he didn't practice at all for a very long time. One of the simple things you can do is create a proper environment for practice, a place that is comfortable, quiet, and clean. A corner of your room that feels uplifted, safe, spacious, and private is good enough. It's worth investing in a proper meditation cushion. If you find ritual appealing, set up a table with candles, a flower, incense, pictures, whatever inspires you, and meditate in front of that. But again, don't get caught up in chasing your idea of the perfect environment in which to meditate. Some people from the city will go into the mountains to meditate in peace, and find that the crickets and the birds won't shut up. When I was in my teens, I went on several practice and study intensives with Lama Ugyen Shenpen, one of my tutors. On our retreats, he always insisted that we wash and dress properly in the morning, even though we stayed in rustic cabins in the mountains, miles from anyone to see. He was just passing on what he'd learned from being on retreat with great masters in Tibet, who taught the importance of taking good care of ourselves and our meditation environment. Having some sense of basic dignity in our appearance and environment helps support meditation practice. In Tibet and other Buddhist countries, lamas, monks, and nuns wear robes. While we in the West might regard robes as the lowest common denominator of clothing, the Buddha taught his disciples to wear robes with dignity, even specifying that the robes be evenly hemmed and that they fit properly. He taught that dressing well, even in robes, is a way to respect the teachings as well as respecting others and ourselves. Again, it's a matter of dignity. We're presenting ourselves to others so that we are pleasant to look at, and we're respecting our body and our practice that way. This kind of uplifted attitude extends to working with our bodies and nourishing ourselves. We're all aware of how our mind influences what we can do with our body. Conversely, we don't always consider how much influence our body has on our mind. If our body is hungry or in pain, it's hard to stabilize our mind. They have to be in harmony. Openness and flexibility of body encourages these same qualities in the mind. A supple body helps support our sitting meditation. Yoga is a traditional and powerful way to open up the body's energy as well as develop flexibility. When I'm on retreat in India, I have the privilege of studying with one of the greatest living masters, Pattabhi Joyce. He's taught me the benefits of doing yoga postures beforehand as one of the most effective ways to relax into meditation practice. I try to take the time to stretch before sitting down. Of course, while yoga is relaxing and energizing, it isn't a substitute for formal meditation. They are two different practices. Even in the ancient Hindu system, the purpose for holding the various postures has always been to prepare the student to work with the mind and develop wisdom. Practicing a martial art, doing Tai Chi or Qigong, or simply getting regular exercise are all good ways to prepare the body for meditation. Of course, the traditional disciplines that work with inner energies and consciousness will have more in common with shamatha and contemplation. For this reason, we have our own system of yoga and Tibetan body training in the Shambhala community. Eating properly is another way to support our practice. Whatever happens in meditation arises from daily life. If we've had a hectic day, for instance, we have to put that into the equation. When I was training horses, I couldn't just barge into the stable, drag the horse out, throw it on the lunge line, and start trying to train it. I had to be sensitive to how the horse was feeling that day. Did it look a little heavier? Was the head down? Were the ears back? What was the tail doing? Was the horse trying to smell me, or was it backing off? In the same way, we need to realize that in terms of our practice, today is always going to be slightly different from yesterday. Preparing the mind begins with stopping for a moment to see what our mind feels like. This is like stepping back and examining the horse we're about to ride. Since the way we feel changes all the time, our practice will need to change as well. Be compassionate and honest about your own needs and, at the same time, apply the necessary discipline. For example, if you're feeling agitated, it might be a good idea to take a slow walk outside before beginning your session. If you're drowsy, you might take a cool shower to wake up before you sit. Perhaps you'd like to read a little about meditation to remind yourself why you are practicing. We also need to be sensitive to what we're thinking as we come into our session. If we just plop down on our cushion straight from the office or right after an argument, the entire meditation period might be spent slowing our mind down enough even to remember that we're meditating. We learn to leave certain things behind. It's like getting into bed. If you sleep naked, you take off all your clothes first. If you leave your jacket and shoes on, you'll be uncomfortable. In meditation, we let go of as much as we can before we sit down. Most days will have enough discursiveness to handle just under ordinary circumstances. Here's a helpful exercise for physical checking in before you sit. Stand with your arms relaxed at your sides, eyes either half closed or shut. Slowly guide your attention up from your feet to the crown of your head. Pause where you find tension or imbalance, and breathe into those areas, allowing the tension to dissolve. Be aware of your body in the space. Feel the support of the ground beneath your feet. Breathe deeply through your nose, exhaling stress, agitation, and tension. Be aware of your body. This exercise allows us to tune in and relax instead of rushing into meditation. The essence of all this preparation is really simple. When we sit down to meditate, we're eliminating all other activities. We chose the time and space wisely to reduce distractions. We prepare our body to relax before we sit. We prepare our mind to be as simple and present as we can be. And we do all this with precision, as well as gentleness. But remember, this is just preparation, not actual meditation. If you try to create ideal conditions, you may never get to the cushion. At some point, you just have to sit down and do it. Appendix B. The Posture of Meditation. 1. The spine is upright, with a natural curve. 2. The hands are resting on the thighs. 3. The arms and shoulders are relaxed. 4. The chin is slightly tucked. 5. The eyelids are half shut. 6. The face and jaw are natural and relaxed. 7. If you're sitting on a cushion, keep your ankles loosely crossed. If you're sitting on a chair, keep both feet firmly on the floor. Appendix C. Instructions for Contemplative Meditation. 1. Calm the mind by resting on the breathing. 2. When you feel ready, bring up a certain thought or intention in the form of words. 3. Use these words as the object of meditation, continually returning to them as distractions arise. 4. In order to help rouse the heartfelt experience of their meaning, think about the words. Bring ideas and images to mind to inspire the meaning. 5. As the meaning of the words begins to penetrate, let the words drop away and rest in that. 6. Become familiar with that meaning as it penetrates. 7. Conclude your session and arise from your meditation with the meaning in your heart. Meaning is direct experience, free of words. 8. Now enter the world aspiring to conduct yourself with the view of your contemplation. For example, if you have been contemplating the preciousness of human birth, your view will be one of appreciation. This concludes Turning the Mind into an Ally by Sakyong Mipham. Narrated by Neil Heligers. Copyright 2013 by Mipham J. Mukpo. This unabridged audiobook is recorded by arrangement with Riverhead Books, an imprint of Penguin Publishing Group, a division of Penguin Random House, LLC, and was produced in the year 2018 by Tantor Media Incorporated, a division of Recorded Books, which holds the copyright there too. Please visit Tantor.com for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.